to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and and with me is Joel. I got the episode releases mixed up, so you were on the last episode I did release.
No,
I was
being played by Harry Belafonte in the other episode, but yes, I usually am here. Usually.
This is the first part of the 2018 pairing. This is Black Klansman with not Green Book, because I don't want to watch that movie. I'd rather watch Shocker again, and that movie should get more love, even though it does get a lot of love. But I love Shoplifter, so we will talk about that next episode. But to start off, we have returning guest Travis Woods.
Hello, 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 hello.
Hey. So, what made you want to pick Black Klansman?
Well, I mean, well, first off, and if I recall correctly, I can swear on here, right?
Yeah, you can.
Oh, it's just a fucking great genre movie. It's a really great Sidney Lumet-esque crime film. It's great. It's just a lot of fun. It's a great genre film. Spike can be really, really, really great at that. He's a walking, talking repository of cinema, and a huge fan of 70s films and the New York Sidney Lumet crime films. And as we've seen with Inside Man, when he really wants to pull the ripcord on that, he really, really does it. And Black Klansman is just a great cop and crime movie, 70s cop and crime film.
I never even made that connection until he just said it. It being like a Sidney Lumet type of movie. Now
it really
makes
is.
So much more sense.
And
Joel, do you
like Spike
when did
movies?
You first
yeah,
okay. Yes. When did you first see Black Klansman? In the theater or afterwards?
I definitely saw it in the theater. I feel like I mean, we were doing the podcast when this came out, right?
Yeah, the Kurosawa. Wait.
Oh, we were doing, but oh, okay, but we already knew we were going to be doing this one.
Oh yeah.
At that point, so I think we were both kind of, you know, relatively excited. You can't get too excited necessarily for Spike Lee movie. Sorry, Spike. but I mean, it, didn't know how it was going to go with the trailer. So yeah, I think about 2 weeks after it came out, I usually wait a little bit. But saw it at the theater. It had a real big impact with the big image, but I mean, when I watched it at home for this recording, it still was very impactful.
Oh, yeah. This was the first Spike I ever saw in a theater, because that's where I live. The last one that came to theater was the World War II one. That's kind of boring. St. Anna. And that kind of, I didn't want to go see that, and I didn't like going to theater when Inside Man came out. So in between that, all the other ones never really made it near me, even Chirac. So for me, this was kind of a big Spike movie, because it's the first one I finally got to see in the proper setting. So even though it's not my favorite, it is up there with the ones I really like. Overall.
So let's see. Top of the line here. I mean, what what's your comparison? Which one do you think it's most like?
Soul Days mixed with Bamboozled.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say I really hate when people use that critical shorthand of if X and Y had a baby, it would be Z. But for me, it's if Bamboozled and Inside Man had a baby. Mm-hmm. Pure genre film, along with a really kind of scarring commentary on how race is portrayed by the media, by films in this specific case, just kind of conjoined at the hip, and that's Black Klansman to me.
And I need to get this out late early on. There's another a couple other movies called Black Klansman. There's one from the 60s that is not great. It's a Ted Mikkels picture, so with him it's kind of 70-30. You're gonna get something decent. The 30% is a decent part, and it's not very good. And if you ever if you're curious about watching that one, don't bother. It's not really worth it. Yeah, so how you guys want to approach this? Like, kind of like talk about, well, actually, Travis, you didn't talk about Spike that much the first time you're on. What's your history with Spike?
Let's see. First Spike Lee film I ever saw was Malcolm X. I was 10 years old, and just to show you how old I am. I was 10 years old when it came out, and I saw it theatrically when it came out. I was really curious about it. It was, I think, one of the first prestige films that I was really aware of growing up as a kid, happening in that moment. And I don't know why, I was very, very curious. Because of that, it felt like when it came out, that X symbol was ever present, and I was just really curious about it. So I went and saw it, and of course, because I was 10 and an idiot, had no real idea what I was watching. And then I think, like a lot of people, I started catching up to him when I was in high school and college. When I was in high school, I worked at a video store, and I basically just, I believe He Got Game came out the first summer I worked at a video store, and I actually started with He Got Game and worked my way backwards to She's Gotta Have It, and loved just about all of it. And that's also probably why I'm one of the few people walking around on planet Earth with a really big soft spot for He Got Game. I don't feel like that's.
You're not alone. I have a real soft spot for it. It has its problems, certainly, but it stars my favorite NBA players, so I have to like it on some level.
It's not the nice. It's not the most adroit or sensitive film in its portrayal of women or Spike's attitude towards them or perceived attitude towards them.
I don't know
But
what you're talking about.
I also look at it. I honestly feel like it's his big Technicolor religious epic film. And if I ever get a free extra 5 minutes, I'd really love to sit down and write something on that. I really do feel like it's his big Cecil B. DeMille religious epic film. And I think
Not sure if you heard our episode on it, but
did.
our guest John Cribbs described it like his superhero movie.
Yeah, and I can see it, and I can see why you'd say that. And I did. I listened to that episode in a jealous rage for not being on it.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I ground my teeth into powder while listening, but I got through it. I enjoyed it. But yeah, that's I watched Malcolm X when I was a kid, didn't understand it, came back to it as an adult and loved it. Starting with Summer, or excuse me, He Got Game, I just worked my way backwards, and now I've bounced my way forwards. And I would also say that Black Klansman is, I don't know if you can call it the best of his 20th, 21st century films, but it might be my favorite of them.
I forgot going like post Bamboozled. That's my favorite Spike movie by far. Well, not by far. I'd say like after that, probably The Sweet Blood of Jesus is the one I like the most after Bamboozled, and then I'd probably throw in like this tied with 25th Hour.
Yeah. But like I said, it might not be his app the absolute peak of his filmmaking in this century, but it's right up there next to it. I cannot sing this film's praises enough. I really adore it. I really, like I said, I'll beat this drum until you guys mute me. I really do think it's a really enjoyable mixture of when he does pure genre work, like something like Inside Man, but it's also a sociopolitical statement, And I think what is so great about it, and I know that some critics, when it came, they accused it of being tonally inconsistent, which I know Spike has a problem with. I don't think he actually has a problem with it here. I think that he's very, very purposefully trying to make a feel-good movie that, with its very, very bleak ending, it's the equivalent of there's a friend of mine on Twitter who Damon Ho, who wrote that this movie is structured like Muhammad Ali's Rope-A-Dope, in that you don't see those final 3 or 4 minutes coming, and when they do hit you, they just knock you the fuck out, because you were sitting here
That's
thinking
true.
you were watching. And I know that some people criticized the film for doing that, saying it was either exploitative by having footage of the Unite the Right rally at the ending. They thought it was either exploitative of that, or it was jarringly inconsistent. And I think being jarringly inconsistent was actually the entire purpose and goal, is to make us feel comfortable watching a movie in which the racists are all yokels and idiots, and we can make fun of them and comfortably laugh at them from our privileged vantage of liberality, and we can all pat ourselves on the back for knowing that they're the bad guys. And seeing that kind of structured as a movie narrative, but then right before we walk out of the theater, able to all kind of have a good laugh and, boy, hey, that was a real good one. Just the
That's
devastating
true.
weakness of seeing a woman killed in front of our eyes, and seeing all of this marching hate, this hate that's captured in the film as a very serious and real thing, but also kind of comfortably and comedically portrayed at times, seeing how it has metastasized in a new century, and
It feels like going
even
back
this
to
president representing it and defending it.
And like going back to what you're saying about the laugh at the yokels, it almost feels like his version of Blazing Saddles a little bit, except a little more serious minded than Blazing Saddles.
I mean,
But
it's full of that sense of humor. I think that that slap in the face at the end, yeah, it's like he had one of the things I really like about the movie, especially on this rewatch I just did, is that it feels like I don't know if he got to say everything he wanted to say, but it feels like he did it, and that's like and it's like he had these messages he wanted to make sure you got, like you woke up finally to hear what he actually wanted you to hear. And he was also like, I am going to make this genre movie, and people are going to be entertained by it. But yeah, it's like, just in case you didn't get what the movie was about, this is your last wake-up slap.
It's like going back to school days. It's the end of school days. Those freshmen are screaming at us, wake up.
That's also the beginning of Do the Right Thing is Samuel L. Jackson yelling, "Wake up!"
Oh yeah, that is true. And
And I
I
also,
guess
oh, go ahead.
what do you consider like using the footage thing to like to make a point? Would you consider like Old Boy with him using the 9/11 footage the same thing, or Old Boy, do you think that's more just him just like showing the passage of time?
I think that's what it was, and just the passage of time in that case. Like, what better way to show the big events that he missed by being locked in this room? I mean, that's just an indication, like, this touched the entire world kind of thing. Because in the original Old Boy, it wasn't just America stuff. Like, it was in the
It
remake.
was, yeah, that's true. And the original did have the 9/11 footage too.
No, I mean the footage at the end of this movie is just the footage, right? He's not like playing
No, it's literally, it's the news footage and it's the cell phone footage of people who were there. And what I think is also really important and potent about its usage is, a lot of this film, like Bamboozled, is kind of examining the way movies and film have portrayed race in America. I mean, it opens with that, with a sequence from Gone with the Wind, which is seen as one of the great masterpieces of cinema, but, is also a film that portrays the Confederacy as a deeply, deeply sympathetic entity, and
Although
that
Hollywood does have a history of that.
you
Like, even on the Twilight Zone, like, every time there'd be, like, a Civil War episode, it'd always be the Confederates. So, like, it's just a weird, troubling thing that Hollywood and American entertainment tends to do.
Yeah, and I feel like that a big part of this film, there's an undercurrent in this film that is examining cultural portrayals and narratives of race in America, both with this opening shot of Gone with the Wind, and showing it's that sequence where Scarlett is walking amongst all of the Confederacy war wounded and war dead, and it's this swelling score and this gorgeous crane shot, and it's all like this tribute to the efforts of the South. And then later, obviously, there's a huge subplot involving the film The Birth of a Nation. And
Yeah, and you see some clips of Birth of a Nation early on.
yeah, and this is a film that, as Spike Lee has said himself, that at NYU they showed this film when he was going to NYU. And, he was like, they talked about all the great innovations that D.W. Griffith came up with, but they never talked about how this film was used as a recruiting tool for the Klan and was responsible for black people getting lynched. And so he directed a short film while at NYU called The Answer, which is about a black screenwriter who has to, write a $50 million remake of The Birth of the Nation. And I really feel like so much of Black Klansmen is a response to these cultural portrayals and narratives, with this film, a good deal of this film feeling like a piece of counter narrative. But then that its detractors could argue, if someone actually wanted to be that big of an asshole, they could just label this film as just counter propaganda to the propaganda of Gone with the Wind and The Birth of the Nation. And I think the reason why having that footage from the Unite the Right rally at the ending is so important on many levels, I think one of the thematically important levels is that it keep you with that in this film, you cannot label Black Klansmen as just counter programming or counter propaganda, because with that in the film, it allows us to say, this isn't propaganda. This isn't a fictional retelling. This really fucking happened. This is not just a fictionalized retelling of a true story. This is shit that really goes down. This is not propaganda. And I think it so weaponizes the rest of the film. And, just before the show, we were talking about The Irishman. Spoilers, 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 spoilers for anyone listening. But I'll try to withhold the biggest spoilers. But there's a big part of watching The Irishman, I feel like, is you're watching it for the first 2.5 hours, not quite sure what this is, and it's only in the last hour that recontextualizes everything that came before it, and all of a sudden the film ties together. And I feel like in a weird way, having this 5-minute chunk of real life horror at that rally, featuring that in the film, it recontextualizes everything that came before it. And not just the Unite the Right sequence, but also that incredible the Spike characters on a dolly sequence that immediately precedes it.
Oh, yeah. And,
And
like, that really sticks out because, like, it's just, if you're familiar with Spike, like, that shot will show up somewhere. And it's like, when it shows up there, like, it really just pinpoints, like, now you pay the fuck attention to this moment.
It felt like it was him saying, "Oh, don't forget, you're watching a fucking Spike Lee movie. Did you forget? Did you forget because you were having a good time? Because this is a Spike movie." And I feel like that dolly shot was him, his way of going, "Don't forget who made this, just because you're having a great time. Like, this is something real." And yeah, I know, again, some people call it exploitative, but I think that the addition of that footage is what really pushes this into one of his great works for me.
But I think it's important to note that Jordan Peele was a producer on this, and like having an outside force like Jordan Peele kind of helped focus Spike, I feel like, because he tends to like go off in crazy directions sometimes with stuff like, She Hate Me, and you could argue Bamboozled does that also, and having like someone else step in and kind of rein him in, and like I think that's part of why this movie was so successful, was that there were outside forces to rein in his ideas. And also I feel like Kevin Willmott, the co-screenwriter that he co-wrote Chirac with, kind of helped with that too, because Chirac in some ways feels like a more focused film with like what's trying to get across. Yeah, I feel like the addition of like like other people that he doesn't work with usually just helped make this a more mainstream film, because like pretty much before the Chirac I don't like as much. I have more problems with that one, but that kind of like
Wait, what? Who? What? You lost your train of thought?
yes, I did.
Okay.
I'm just trying to say like the Kevin Willmott, and it kind of helps like focus in things so he doesn't go too wildly off the rails, and like so like it's like that's I think it's part of why this movie was so mean was such a hit
You feel
compared
like a
to.
guiding hand is. I mean, has he ever had somebody that had influence that way, as far as you know?
As far as I know, not really. Maybe it's like on BlacKkKlansman, like Jordan Peele, because he's kind of like a like the new hot director right now. So maybe that like that could play a part. But but looking at the next his movie coming up, The Five Bloods, it's an epic war movie. So I'm a little worried it might end up like Miracle of Saint Anna. I don't know. We'll see when that comes out.
I also think this is definitely like this might be his tightest film, in that his editor Barry Alexander Brown even went so far as to say in an interview there were no deleted scenes for this film,
Yeah,
which
I don't
is
believe that, by the way.
well, it's hard to believe because it's Spike Lee, which is, who is a director who and a writer who never met a subplot that he didn't fall in love with. And so I don't know if that's an exaggeration. I assume it's an exaggeration. There have to be some little snips here and there, but it does have the feeling, I think what Brown was trying to get across is just about everything Spike was being, I think, very economical in what he was shooting, so that most of what was shot didn't make it on the screen. But it is a ludicrously airtight film for him, in that I can't think of a single. And I could be wrong, but I can't think of a single subplot in this film that is not intrinsically tied to the overarching plot. That there's nothing here that you could, to bring back, He Got Game. You could make an argument that the Jovovich subplot in that film, while thematically linked to the overall story, you could probably still cut that, and the film itself would survive. I don't think that there's anything in BlacKkKlansman that you could cut that would not critically wound the film. Like, that's how airtight it is, which is, I think, even with his great work, I think is something that Spike struggles with.
Yes, I see. I mean, like, it definitely is his most straightforward movie he's done. Like, I guess done in a while, because like I think of like School Days as being like his like the 80s stuff is definitely more focused when he was younger, but this is like the most focused one, and I don't know. I guess The People at Jesus is pretty focused in, but that's also like
I mean, it's a remake-ish, so.
the remake, so.
I mean, Inside, the one that we compared to, Inside Job, is such a tight, like, crime movie. Con movie, basically. But I, of course, the reveal at the end feels weird. Not the Clive Owen reveal, but the reveal of what was in the box feels weird in that movie. But I still think that movie is pretty freaking tight. I would compare it to this one. Although I'm trying to think of Black Klansman, I was like, well, would I excise that? Would I excise this? No. And I think that I didn't think that necessarily the first time I watched it. The first time I watched it, I think I thought it was a bit long, but it was still, you know, it's still great, and I was involved the whole time. But this time it was like, no, you have to have that, because like there are so many scenes that may feel excessive to people who aren't realizing how often he is just like looking at the audience, referencing the audience, breaking the fourth wall, being anachronistic on purpose, you know, all these things like that. It's like, no, you really can't take anything out. But I do feel like there are some scenes that just kind of like switch to another scene, and it's like, wait a minute, I feel like we skipped a beat here, you know. So it probably is just like,
yeah,
you know, 10 seconds of footage that he clipped off or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things that could be a little extraneous, do we want to talk about Alec Baldwin as Dr. Kennebrew Beauregard?
I always forget that's in the movie.
Yeah, me too. I also forget.
Which comes right after the Gone with the Wind intro. It's a beat that feels very Spike to me. So I would be loath to lose it.
Yeah.
Because it gives the film some of that. Because this doesn't feel like an anonymously directed film, but it does feel like for a long bit of it, some of the wilder, more unpredictable elements of Spike's aesthetic are not here. And that is like, that's kind of like him popping up just for a second before letting the story kick off. And I do get a kick out of that.
And it sets up thematically what you're going to see, because like you get the like white nationalism, and you get the clips of Birth of a Nation. Yeah. And, you know, so like it's setting up everything you're about to see.
And I wanted to mention, if you guys wouldn't mind me making a bit of a statement of personal backstory, but I did want to mention the weird relationship that I have with the world of this film. Mm-hmm. Speaking of white nationalists, and no, I'm not coming out to say I'm a white nationalist.
this would be a weird show for I'm that.
But, you know, speaking of white nationalists like Dr. Kenneth Beauregard or whatever the hell his name is, I grew up in Southwest Missouri in a very small 2-stoplight town called Aurora. And this was the kind of very isolated and very winter's bone type place to grow up in. And it was the kind of place in which Confederate flags were not only on the back of trucks with gun racks, but they were in the windows of people's homes. They were fluttering in the breeze in front of City Hall. And it was also a place in which the Ku Klux Klan was still very prevalent. They weren't, you know, running around in white hoods everywhere, but they were definitely there. They were present, and everyone knew who they were and what they were. Yeah. And there was no fear or shame, that they had no fear or shame in letting that be known, and it was just an accepted thing, which is really horrifying. And when I was 17 years old in high school, I was a intern at my local newspaper, the Aurora Advertiser, and every week, like clockwork, we would receive a letter to the editor that they would print, because it was unfortunately, it was the only newspaper we had, but it was a very conservative newspaper. And it would be a letter to the editor by this guy named Frazier. And he was writing all sorts of things about white nationalism, paganism, white separatism, anti-Semitism, rising up against the government, all sorts of white patriotism, the Klan, which he was a very active member in. He was a member of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan before he moved to Aurora, my hometown. And anyway, for years, once a week, he would send in a letter. And while working there, I got sick of this, and I sent one back and had it published. And basically just being a snotty, 17-year-old whose heart was in the right place, and just talking shit about this guy that I just saw as a goofball racist. And he sent a letter back saying that he was going to shoot me in the head in the parking lot of the newspaper. And so there was a 2-week period where I had to have like the police there every time I would leave, and drive home, and when I would go to school, and because my dad was a prominent member of the city government, so he did me that solid. But essentially, we laughed him off. We laughed him off as a hillbilly joke and an idiot and a harmless coot that, threatened me with a gun as an example of his impotence and harmlessness, because he would only threaten, not actually do something. About 14 years later, that man, Frazier Glenn Miller, was the man who shot and killed 3 people at the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park, Kansas, in
Oh, shit.
2014. And he's currently on death row for that. I don't know if you guys remember that, but it was a really devastating and disgusting and horrible shooting. I mean, all shootings are, but this was a disgustingly racially motivated mass killing. And that's ever since that happened, it's really stuck with me that, in a way, and I felt very, I that's something I felt resonate with me when I was watching this film, as we're watching this movie about these people that we're laughing at, and they're just goofball hicks until they're not, and then they cross over and they become something else. And I think that is so much what this film is trying to do, and so much of what this film is saying. Is, as we were talking earlier, yeah, these guys, they're idiots, they're fun to laugh at, ha ha ha, they're hillbilly hicks and they eat squirrels and whatever else, and that's all well and good until the day it stops and it's not a joke. That level of hate that is being portrayed, you can't just laugh it off, because then one day it might come back and fire a gun at you, or set a bomb off where you're at, or drive a car through a crowd that you're standing in. And yeah, don't mean to get super, super downer and depressing on the podcast here, but
Yeah,
that's
why did this get so political? No, I'm just kidding.
But when I made it to the end of this movie for the first time, that's the only person I could think about was old Frazier Miller, on death row in my home state, who once joked, or what I once took as a joke, when he threatened to shoot me in the head, and then he killed 3 people in exactly that manner. I think it just goes to show that, exactly what Spike is doing, which is this: you can laugh at this, but you can't just laugh at this. That this level of hatred is serious, and it kills people. And that's where I grew up. That's where my happy childhood was, in that lovely town, which is also home to, anytime you see pictures of that Unite the Right rally, there's always, there's that one nerd with his slicked over hair, and he's like screaming directly at the camera. There's always a guy next to him in all those pictures. If you go and look, there's a guy in a black polo shirt with red hair, kind of a pointy nose. That guy, he's legally changed his name to Ted Van Nukem, after Duke Nukem, the video game character, which shows you what a cool guy he is. He lives three houses down from my dad in my hometown.
Oh, jeez, that's scary.
And so that's the town I came from, as both a member of the Unite the Right, and this guy, this and old Ted Van Nukem. I recognize him in the footage of that, that's used at the end of BlacKkKlansman. He lives on the same street as my family,
Like
which is
my
like another reason that this film is particularly resonant for me, is it's showing me people I literally know, not just reminding me of people that I knew.
Yeah, like for I get like my weird connection to I live near I live in Delaware, and over the border to Maryland, there's an area that the KKK is still fairly active. At least when I was in high school, they were still very active. Now I suspect it might be the same. At the high school I went to, we couldn't play them in this one high school in Maryland in any sports, because there were a time the bus from my school would drive there. There would be like a big organized white nationalist protest because there were too many black students that went to my high school, and there were like too many black on a basketball team and football team, and it became such a problem that that school kind of got blacklisted from like playing schools in my area.
Jesus. This has turned into a really heavy episode.
Joel, do you have anything?
Do you have a depressing story from your childhood, Joel, that you'd like to also share with us?
I believe I've shared previously about how I've lived with casual racism my whole life, so not anything. Yeah, I've never had anything where I felt in danger. I have the benefit of looking white despite being half Mexican. So,
Well, the movie does talk about passing
yeah,
in
I'm one of
a
those
pivotal
guys.
scene.
And I'm always like, it's great to be a white American.
And
Also, I thought it was
there's
really interesting.
another,
Oh, go ahead.
I forgot where it was in the movie, but I think it was something with maybe the Felix guy. I think it was Felix and Walter, because like I went to college in West Virginia. And I told a story in the Watermelon Man, Melvin and Peebles episode. But I knew people who I now realize were who might have joined KKK when I was in college, and they were fine with me because I am light skinned, and I don't act like I don't act ghetto or hood. So, like seeing like Walter in this movie again, it was like, oh, I've met these people. This is a little uncomfortable knowing I've met these people when I was in college. I won't say I was friends with them, but like, this friends of friends. Yeah, not to say West Virginia is all racist. My dad grew up there. Like, where he grew up is relatively safe.
So
I feel
that
like we
was
all
a pretty good movie,
need a
guys.
stiff. Yeah, we really all need a stiff drink now. After all this sharing, which is. We shouldn't probably go too far afield, though, from the fact that this is a very funny film. This is a very fun movie.
It does awakens like
But
the type of discussion.
it does have that rope-a-dope at the end. It just breaks your jaw when it hits you and doesn't let you just walk away going, well, that was a funny crime flick. That was cool. That was good. Even though it is all of those things, it is really good and it is funny and it's a great crime film. And I think that that again, I think that he made it might not be his ultimate 21st century masterpiece, but I think it's right up there because of how it does take each of us to a place that it does take us to that where we can't just walk away and go, well, that was cool, that was good, that was fun. Spike's back, afraid this was gonna be another old boy, but this is great stuff, good deal. It really does hit you. And what is maybe most interesting is that it's like he deploys these little sticks of dynamite throughout the film, but you don't really know that they're there. And oh gosh, I don't want to, God, I'm getting ready to use a metaphor that would make him sound like the evil bomber at the end of this goddamn movie. I don't mean to do that, but it is like he does put these charges throughout the film, but it's like they don't go off until you see that ending. And then retroactively, all of these little things, these little barbs that were in the film that didn't cut you the first time, they do upon a rewatch. And I think that's really incredible. He really built a movie that has to be re-seen.
And on that note, when do you think Flip changes? Because watching it this time, I was really trying to like focusing on Adam Driver's performance and being like trying to figure out when does he finally switch over? Because like there's a point where I thought he did switch over. It was I think when they call the emergency meeting and they like talk about attacking the Patrice character. But then that's followed up with him talking to him, Ron, in like the file room. So I'm not sure like when. Like, do you think there's a point that you can tell where he changes?
Do you mean change like he's
When
more like down with the stated mission of the group?
the clan, like when he's The end is basically saying like he's still in the group that's under his real name probably, but at least that's how I have always that's how I have always interpreted the last shot of the film proper.
That Flip is still with the clan? Oh no, I don't. I don't feel like he's still. I think he's. I never got that sense that
Oh.
he's one of them.
What are you talking? Yeah. That's the Adam
Oh
Driver
really?
character, right?
Yeah, I thought he, because you see the beard under the thing, under the hood. So I always took that as that's Flip.
I mean, all white men are responsible for this, so yeah, I mean, possibly. But so is everyone else, of course. Now, I didn't think that was Flip.
Oh, or maybe it's, I guess it's
Yeah,
supposed to be nice.
the reason I wouldn't think of that was Flip, in addition to that, is how quickly and desperately he tries to prevent the bombing, how you
Oh,
at
that's true.
Patrice's house, he does have kind of that one of the two big hero shots. Ron has the first when he shows up, but Flip, he's the one that shows up to try to like both prevent the bombing and also save Ron's ass when the two kind of anonymous Colorado Springs officers are arresting him for attacking the woman whose name I can't remember, but is packing the bomb.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think he switches over.
No.
I mean, I do know the shot you're talking about, that very kind of strange close up of the man with the beard, but I don't think that that's the Adam Driver.
I mean,
I think it's
it might
another beard.
actually be Adam Driver, the actor, but it might, yeah, it's not the character.
Oh,
Because
okay.
he, I mean, how would he get back into the Klan if they already know he was pretending to be?
Okay, you're right. This is, I don't know. This is like that shot is like is I'm still not sure. Is that supposed to be someone we've seen already, or is it just like hate continues and you can't stop it?
I think it's probably meant to be more of the latter because I do know the shot you're talking about, and I did expect there just in the way that it's framed and that slow push, and I was expecting there to be some strange reveal, like maybe it was the police chief or that it was someone we were going to recognize just because of how pregnantly the camera pauses on this hooded head. But in the end, I think it was, as you said, it just meant to be that hey, it's still there, it's still lurking. You can see its eyes shining in the dark, with the flames dancing in its eyes. But I don't think it's meant to be. I don't think it's meant to be Flip. I think, especially because there was that controversy after the film's release, where Boots Riley, he took issue with Spike portraying the police, or at least members of the police department, as being capable of heroism. And Spike's rebuttal to that was, look at my films, they've all been very critical of the police, but on the other hand, I'm not going to say all police are corrupt or that all police hate people of color. I'm not going to say that. We need the police. And in his argument with Boots, he never once said, oh, and by the way, I have. What are you talking about? I have Flip show up as a Klansman at the end. And so if he, since he didn't say that, I don't think it's intended to be Flip. I think it's just intended to be another threatening white face.
On Spike and Boots Riley, Spike was kind of, as usual, a little immature and petty with his responses to Boots Riley. Because I think they like ran to each other a little bit later after that. And I don't know what Spike said, but it was something. It was like an uncalled for, like dick at him.
Yeah, the man does not like to be criticized.
Joel, were you saying something?
No. What is your guy's favorite performance in this?
Favorite performance.
Oh.
But before I get to that,
No, my
like
question first.
the
No, I'm just kidding.
Like the thing, the movie that kind of holds it back for me is just the Patrice Ron romance, which it's the second time through I still don't buy that romance. I don't feel much chemistry between them. It just feels like it always feels like they're on a first date, even at the end. It feels like they're on a first date. Like it never feels. I'm not sure like what the timeline is supposed to be exactly, but it must be
That's a good point.
I mean,
like, I don't know,
he does develop,
a
yeah.
few months, a year. And it's like it's kind of develops, and it's like, I mean, they're develops, but like I never really feel that.
Well, this
It
is
feels like
the
Spike trying.
This is a rare movie where he didn't take an opportunity to have a naked female at any
That
point.
is true.
But
I'm sure Jordan Peele and other people were like, hey, no lesbians.
But it's
No, I
also
agree.
like since her she didn't actually exist, like there was no, as far as I know, an equivalent of her character. I think she seems kind of hollow, kind of like a soundboard and something for him to, a catalyst for his even changing his attitude. Yeah, if I had a problem, I think I would mostly have the problem with the same spots you're talking about, their relationship.
Your stance on.
Oh, it's just because I thought that, I think one of the best parts, the best made films, or the films with the best characterizations in them, make you feel like when a character exits stage left, he or she is continuing to live and have a life and do things. Like you could make a movie out of whatever they are doing off screen when you're not watching them. We were talking about The Irishman again earlier. Anytime Al Pacino's Jimmy Hoffa is not on the screen, that character is instilled with such life. We could imagine that we could watch a whole movie, and there have been movies about it, about what he's doing when he's not on the screen. And I thought the way you put that, where it seems like they're always on a first date. Patrice does feel like a character who stops existing the second she's not on the screen, and only blinks right back to life when she pops back on. And there's been no intervening time in between. And I think that, yeah, if there is a weakness, it is how her character is handled on a script level, and how she's basically a plot device meant to be, I think, the nagging guilt for Ron about, aren't you betraying the movement by doing this, by working with the police, going undercover, spying on us
Precisely.
during a Stokely Carmichael. And I think it's meant to give. It's a very writerly character in that she exists solely to perform that function and doesn't really exist much as a person. And then, yeah, I agree. That's probably the major weak point of the film, is the way her character is handled.
It's that and like Alec Baldwin are kind of forgettable things about the movie, which are kind of like the most Spike things about the movie, ironically.
Yeah, I don't. I don't want them to say that they're. I mean, if they cut out the Alec Baldwin part, I don't think the movie would be lesser for it. But I also think it sets that fake tone like right away. Like, look how funny this is going to be. Look how much we're going to make fun of these people. By the way, eventually I'm going to kick the chair out from under you. So, but I'm not going to tell you that. Just pretend I didn't say it.
And like going to the Black Power movement thing, it feels like in some ways Watermelon Man, where like it's dealing with a change in identity in like Watermelon Man, Jeffrey, I forgot his last name, but he goes from a bigoted white man to now he's suddenly black, and he's like, it's like he's gone undercover almost, and he realizes how wrong he is, and this feels kind of in a similar vein.
And he somehow
And
gets
Brown
worse at running when he becomes black. That doesn't, that
starts.
just doesn't check out.
It's like, and how else was it? I think that was like the only thing. Like, there's some other things I can't remember because I didn't write them down. But it did remind me of Watermelon Man a little bit.
Not enough animals.
Yes.
Just in general, like there need to be a dog, possibly a police dog. Maybe one of the races have a dog. I'm not picky.
And the during the Birth of a Nation sequence later on, like I'm not sure if this meant to be a joke or not, but like I think it's pretty famous that in Birth of a Nation, it's a lot of white people in blackface, and they're like cheering on, like the proud white Confederates to win. So it's like, is it supposed to be an ironic joke that they're cheering on these men in blackface? That like they don't realize it, or do you think they realize it? That like there's blackface in the movie, that they're not actual black people.
I mean, are they smart enough to know that? I don't know. That's
Yeah,
there's some real
I can't tell if
darkness.
that's like a meta joke or like if I don't know. Am I being too pretentious in like making that connection?
I mean, I think it was just in there because, again, Spike's feelings about the film, but also because that's a very real thing. Apparently, that's a really well documented thing that The Birth of the Nation is a huge centerpiece of large Klan gatherings. Is that it's like the cherry on top of their meetings. Is they will hold a screening of that. It's just, again, part of the bizarre backwards ass nature of the organization, but that's how they climax their big get-togethers.
And like that whole sequence is pretty brilliant, the way Spike does the Harry Belafonte thing, and it's all connecting. And it's like it's just classic filmmaking, the
Yeah.
way it all connects. But okay, Joel, going back to your thing about the best performance,
Oh, I have a thing for that.
I want to add, because I feel like I'm gonna forget, but Isaiah Whitlock Jr. in his very brief part, he gets to say his
Shit.
classic line.
Of course.
Although he gets cut off, and I feel like that's a joke that he gets cut off, but I just want to bring up that he's in this, and he's in the new Spike movie coming out next year, the Five Bloods, and I hope he gets to say shit in that one too.
He can't
But
be in a movie without saying that. Come on.
but best performance, I'd say, the first time I saw it, I didn't think John David Washington was that good, but this time, I appreciate it more. It's definitely low key. He's not his father by any stretch. He's still good, but he's not his dad. But I think he does a very good job of pulling everything together.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's muted, but I also think he's muted on purpose, which, makes for, it's not a showy performance, but it is interesting. My favorite performance, this might be a weird one to pick. Well, really quickly, I will say, Topher Grace, it's unfortunate that this is the role he was born to play, but this is the role he was born to play.
I thought that
He
was
is
Venom.
But he really is perfect at David Duke, which is that sucks for him that he's this good at it. But he's really, really good at it. We're talking about so much about how you can look at these people and laugh. And what's interesting about David Duke is that, the risk at laughing at these people is that you begin to forget how dangerous they are. But the thing about David Duke is, for however dangerous he is also, you can't not laugh at him. He's just a weird, goofy guy. He's had plastic surgery to make himself look more Aryan. And he's just this little nerd, this nebbish little nerd. And Topher Grace so captures that, the awkwardness of that and the unpleasantness of that. And there's just, there are certain people whose faces you kind of look at them and you're like, I would have a good time punching this guy. And Topher Grace sometimes has that, and David Duke has that, and he really, it's, again, it's unfortunate, but it is kind of the role he was born to play. But that said, I think my favorite performance in this film, aside from Harry Belafonte's moment, which is just so harrowing, would be Ryan Eggold, who plays Walter Breachway. That's the guy that's kind of running the local chapter of the Klan. It's the guy that first starts speaking to
With the glasses
Ron
and the
Stahl.
shaved head.
Yeah.
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 And the reason why, is, again, growing up where I did, I knew that guy. The guy who almost treats his hatred and his racism not as a burden, but just, it's a job. It's just something you get up and you do. And it's just part of what your life is. And it's part of your life the way, you know, your car is green, and or that you go to a factory at 8 in the morning. And that's something that I don't think is, that level of subtlety is not often delivered to this type of character. And I don't think it's the kind of subtlety you would expect in a Spike Lee movie when dealing with this type of character. And for the most part, a lot of the other characters don't have that, that are in the Clans of this film.
Do you think Felix is too over the top?
It's not that he's too over top, because there are people like that. I think it's just that it's... I do think it is a bit rare that you get a character like Walter where, like, again, this is just part of his daily life, like going to church, going to work, going to the store. It's just... And part of his life is he has a weekly meeting with people that hate anyone who isn't white. And it does, I don't think it makes him more sympathetic or anything like that. I think he's still an evil man. But
he's more dangerous than Felix.
It's the portrayal of that evil as something that is totally banal. And I think that's something that gets missed, is you either want like a larger than life character or an idiot character, when oftentimes evil is just kind of banal. It's just a banal, regular guy until he acts upon what that evil inside of him. And that kind of banality of evil, I think this actor, Ryan Eggold, he really manages to capture that. He's an evil guy, but he's, you know, it's not evil to him. It's just, it's like going to work for him.
Yeah, like Felix is a wild card who's like dangerous the moment you see him. But like Walter is just controlled, like Lex Luthor, almost like villain. It's like he's just, I shouldn't say villain, but you know what I mean, like he's just so controlled and so like, well, it's, I woke up, now it's time to do my routine.
There's something almost corporate about him and about his approach to racism. Like I keep thinking about when they're having that, when David Duke is in town and they're all walking around in that church, and like whenever Felix is getting a little too loud, and Walter just kind of does that kind of chuckling through gritted teeth. Come on now, Felix, he doesn't want to hear about all this now. Like there's something professional about his hatred and his evil. And again, I feel like that's a tricky thing to convey. I think it's tricky to convey evil as anything other than you really think you're saving the world and you're really being big about it, or you're absolutely black-hearted and evil like Felix, and you're just wanting to taste blood and know what that's like. But to actually just be kind of banal and bland with your evil, I think that's really hard. That's a narrow line to stay balanced upon. And I think that Ryan Eggold did a really great job of that kind of, hey, I'm a normal guy and I'm also evil and I'm part of a plot to murder a lot of innocent people.
I gotta say, Ashley Atkinson, who plays what's his name?
Connie?
Jasper's the actor. Felix. He plays Felix. She plays Felix's wife.
Yeah.
And she just plays so eager and so, like, happy housewife, and yet, like, virulently racist, and in such a way where it's like, you know, when she brings in snacks for their meeting, and then she has, like, interrupts the meeting basically to start reading off an article from whatever, a newsletter, basically twisting the story of this black speaker they had and the students in the car that got pulled over by the white cops, right? And the way she presents it is like, oh, I found this great coupon and I'm gonna go, you know, use it later, and I, oh, you gentlemen, you know.
Yeah.
And it feels somehow like a cartoon and then just too damn real. So
yeah,
I think she knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, I remember like when this came out, like the big article pieces that people would write would focus on her, and I'm just surprised so many people were like white women were racist too. It's like, yeah, they were.
No,
it's something that like I'm surprised so many people felt the need to write articles about. Like, yeah, of course they contributed to the problem. Like, this isn't just a thing of white men, but I think when portrayed in media, it's typically like the dumb white man racist. And it's for some reason the media just kind of has not really shown like the part that white women have played in things like the KKK, which is kind of it's just kind of fucked up just to exclude that, to be like to ignore like the other gender is also doing that too. It's just I don't know how Hollywood's is a weird place when you want to talk about certain things. Okay, there was a line that is almost identical to a line in Todd Solondz's Welcome to a Dollhouse.
Oh, it was
I
totally
forgot who
intentional,
said
yeah.
it. It might be intentional. It's almost the same thing where I think it's the racist cop Landers says, "Oh, you think you're hot shit? You're a cold fart." But in Welcome to Dollhouse, someone, I think Don Wiener says to like a school bully, "You think you're hot shit, but you're cold diarrhea." It's almost the exact same thing, and I feel like that might be intentional.
It's a common turn of phrase.
I like the Todd Solondz one a little more, but I think the wet fart one is supposed to. It's supposed to make Landers seem uncool, also. Like it's.
Well, if we're gonna do quote callbacks, then I gotta fly my flag for He Got Game. It's a little bit, it's a tiny bit, but there's a moment where Ron is being chewed out in the film. And someone just keeps asking, "Do you understand? Do you get it? Do you understand?" And he's like, "I understand. I understand. I overstand. I get it. I understand. I overstand." And that's an ad lib from or that's in He Got Game. There's an ad lib where after Denzel's gotten out of prison and he's living out of a hotel room, and Jim Brown is laying down for him what's going to happen if he tries to sneak out of there because his ankle's been lowjacked. He's like, "You get me? Do you understand?" And Denzel just keeps going, "I understand. I overstand. What do you want from me?" And I just not interesting to anyone but myself, but as someone who does adore He Got Game, I got very tickled that there was a reference to He Got Game in a film in 2018.
That's cool.
Yeah,
And
it
you
should
know
get.
that Washington that Denzel made his son watch his movies over and over again, so it was probably also an ad lib.
And hey, Washington was John David was in he was in Malcolm X for a tiny cameo as well.
Yeah, he played
He's
Spike
one
Lee.
of these.
No, wait.
He's one of the little kids
One of the
towards
cool
the end
kids.
in the Harlem school. Not the first one you see, because they're like five or six. He does stick out like when you know he's in there. I think Denzel's mom was in Malcolm X too. I'm not sure
Wait, there
where
was a
she is
sequel
in
to
that.
Malcolm X?
Yes, there was.
Wow.
I don't know, like the other besides the romance in this movie, the other thing I really don't like is, which it's necessary to the movie, but I don't like it. It's where like they arrest Landers at the end because you
Okay.
know it's just like it kind of annoys me, but I get why it's in there. But still, it's like I don't know. That's pure
It
fantasy.
is,
Like that's.
right? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt, but I do want to jump in as soon as you're done.
No, continue.
I was just gonna say, yes, it is 100% fantasy. Absolutely no way that that possibly happened. And it's I love it because it is Spike being like, well, I know what the audience wants. They want the happy ending, and there's still one bad guy left who hasn't gotten it, right? So we're gonna have a scene where everyone's in on it, and they arrest the racist, and the freaking RoboCop 3 comes out, and he's like, yeah, we caught you, it is bad. It's And not bad acted or anything like that. It just like you can't at least the first time I saw it, I was like, that just feels really false. Like, I wonder why they did that. But on the once again on the rewatch, it like all these things just fit together so well in this puzzle that he wanted the full picture to show exactly what he wanted.
Yeah, again, I don't know that I don't know that final 5 minutes. I don't know if it would hurt quite as much unless he had really overloaded the fictional version, the fictional universe of this film. Unless he had ended it like with, you know, what's that thing they say in Wayne's World, like the mega happy terrific ending or whatever it is. I really do feel like he's almost going out of his way to give us the most plasticine fake happy moment so that gut punch hits all the harder. Like, I really think he's doing everything he can to make us feel good and have this kind of catharsis and then totally rob that catharsis of any meaning of its catharsis. Like, we don't get to have that goosebumped, everything might just be okay feeling. But I really think he, and also because, you know, he's Spike and I do, you know, he does like to go into overload. I think he goes into overload even when he's setting up that ending by going, I'm really going to lord the happy stuff over them. Like, just throw everything at them I can.
It's like the end of Werner Herzog's Bad Lieutenant, except you get the bad part of it.
Yeah.
Which I guess is a spoiler if you haven't seen the remake of Bad Lieutenant.
It's not a remake, what?
It kind of is, kind of isn't. It's a complicated story, not worth getting into. But some of the call-outs, like there's a clear reference to the Trump and current stuff. But one I didn't pick up, but there's one line that I didn't pick up on at the time of when I saw it in the theater, but this time it stuck out, where Walter's wife at one point says she was, she says she was raped by a pack of niggers. And it's like, oh, Mel Gibson. I didn't even notice that little reference.
Oh, there. I never caught that. Wow. I mean, I remember the scene, but I didn't make that corollary. Shit.
Yeah, and I should say we are not going to talk about Braveheart because Mel Gibson is racist, and as far as I know, he has not apologized or done anything to shed that image. So we are going to cover the Cannes winner of 95 instead.
I thought we were not covering Braveheart because I don't think it's as good as everyone says it is.
Oh, that too.
Oh, okay.
But fuck Mel Gibson.
Yeah. this just in, fuck Mel Gibson. Okay.
During the Stokely Carmichael scene, you get these shots of people's heads with a black background.
Yeah.
And that feels like a callback to Chameleon Street. Towards the end, it's when Doug Street and his wife are like in therapy, and you get these images of their heads on a black background as they're talking to each other. And it feels like a callback to that. And the part where the Klan members are at the target practice and they're shooting up the targets, it's a clear reference to the spook who sat by a door, because there's a sequence of I forgot who it was, but it was the Black Revolutionaries shooting up a bunch of targets out in the wilderness.
Yep.
Which, and there's other connections to Spook Is Sat by a Door, but I won't say them because kind of spoils some of
the movie, but the actual
impact movie. Of the movie. Yeah. Which we will work on cover in a little bit, which I'm real excited about. That movie's fucking incredible.
Cool.
Have you guys done an episode on that film, or are you going? Are you saying you're going to?
We are going to in a month or two from when this gets released.
That is a wild, wild film. We're supposed to be talking about Black Klansman, but that is a wild goddamn film.
Yeah, like when people say oh, this movie's dangerous. It's like, sure, whatever. Then I saw the spook set by a door. Like, oh shit, this is a dangerous movie.
Yeah.
Like, But yeah, that movie's so good. But that's. Oh wait, have you seen Chameleon Street, Travis?
No, I have not.
No, it's kind of real hard to find, but it's, this is great independent black film from the 80s about this con artist named Doug Street Jr.
I didn't get to give my
It's
2 cents on that movie, and yeah,
give your reason.
it was really funny, like super enjoyable.
Yeah, it's real funny. It's real insidious, and it's about this evil guy who exists, and he's in prison for like a while, and he's back in prison now for the same shit he did in the 70s. Yeah, so yeah, that's it. BlacKkKlansman, not my favorite Spike, but it definitely is up there. It's a crowd pleaser, and
Can I
it's a
say?
good reminder. Yeah, you can go.
Just one last thing I wanted to say. I found it really hard to watch this time, and it has nothing to do with like the level of quality. It has to do with at the time when it came out last year. I was like, "That's a good movie," and I'm glad somebody's saying something. At this point, we've gone so far, in my opinion, in the wrong direction in this country. I had to stop it and split it into 2 days because I was like, okay, this is a bit on my nose right now. Not on the nose, directly, punching my brain, and I'm like, oh God, it only got worse.
I have done a lot of research into minstrelsy and blackface history, so I'm pretty used to fucked up racial things when it comes to American culture and history. So, like, this isn't that hard of a watch until the footage at the end. Which is why I also have seen Bamboozled multiple times. So like I'm kind of not immune to the impact of like certain images. It's just like I can handle it, and it still is as effective.
What you're saying is you don't see color, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I don't see color. All people are saying. Okay, so Travis, any final thoughts?
Oh God. I mean, I feel like I could go on forever about this film, but no, I just like I said, why this is probably my favorite Spike Lee film in quite a long time is I think he is an incredibly, incredibly gifted filmmaker. Obviously, you guys think the same. I mean, you're doing a show on the man, but I think he makes these incredibly incisive and infuriating and ingenious sociopolitical films about the state of who we are and where we are. But then he also can make these really incredibly with this massive film history that he's amassed. He can make these incredibly slick genre films. And I really love that BlacKkKlansman is this synthesis of those two elements of his career. And it is almost seamless in how they come together in this movie. And it's just incredible to me. I think it's him at the height of his powers. I love that he's deploying all of his so many of his incredible aesthetic tricks and skills for what at first feels like a 70s buddy cop movie. And then again, that just the devastating kind of stroke of genius of the final 5 minutes. Yeah, I absolutely adore it, and it's a film that's made to be rewatched. And if anyone's listening who's only seen it once, I would almost beg that they go back and watch it a second or third time because it really does pay off.
Everything that you said basically, like, yes, watching a second time really does pay off. So much stuff that I did not pick up on first time was very clear, and like some of the cultural references and messages and stuff. Even though like Spike, it can like hit you overhead with the image of the message, but like he still can be subtle with like with with certain themes and topics. But
I mean, that's what I said before, that it affected me in a way that it didn't the first time, where I could I had to split it up. I guess the last thing I would say is that if you know somebody who hasn't seen this movie, you should show it to them.
And agreed.
With no, like, well, I know they don't like this kind of movie, or I know they're a Republican or something like that. People should just see this movie.
Let's see. So other movies came out in 2018. And Travis, you can go first with your picks of 2018 movies.
I've got two 2018 movies that would make for maybe the most depressing double feature that I could think of from last year. And like Black Klansman, they use a genre as a chassis to kind of build onto that chassis something that is entirely different, using a genre to kind of subversively do something that kind of undercuts that genre and goes beyond that genre. And the first film of that double feature would be Mandy, Panos Cosmatos's Mandy, which, you know, if you've only seen the trailer and you're like, oh, it's a Nicolas Cage chainsaw fighting movie, which the trailer very much makes it appear to be, I would say that, it, like Black Klansman, it is so much more than what it seems on the surface. It is a film that employs the structure of a revenge film to then explore really, really deep and sad and disturbing elements of grief and what it is like to be a person who is left behind after someone they care about dies. And gone are all the revenge genres, you know, by the numbers, rape and murder sequences, so that there can be this 80-minute canon films, you know, Charles Bronson killing thugs extended sequence. Instead, it's a film that spends its entire first hour dedicated to its female lead character, and then spends the second hour of that film showing how awful the world is in her absence. And it's just a film that uses the revenge thriller genre as a way to explore grief and life after death. And it's an absolute visually stunning masterpiece, which is a really generic critic phrase now that I've said it. But it is visually gorgeous. It is literally face melting. It's an absolutely incredible experience, and I highly recommend anyone who hasn't seen it.
Truly like one of the most original movies I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it's like someone just scooped together an armload of Buñuel and Friday the 13th movies and put them in a blender and, you know, sprinkled it with maybe a little bit of acid and cocaine. And it's a really incredible film, and if nothing else, if you sit down and watch it, you know, it's like nothing else you have ever seen. I will say that it's really incredible. And the second half of that really depressing revenge genre double feature from 2018 for me would be Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here, starring Joaquin Phoenix. I think it's in a very different way a still very extraordinarily expressionistic and haunting and luminous film that really disrupts the pulp tropes of the damaged man saves helpless girl movie, and in its portrayal of a man dealing with PTSD while trying to rescue children from sex rings, Lynn Ramsey subverts along the way every single thing you expect to see in that kind of movie. And there, you know, spoiler, there's no cathartic final battle or gloriously suicidal sacrifice of the man to save a girl. It doesn't leverage the girl's tragedy for the hero's redemption. It's really a story about post-traumatic stress and about how having to discover empathy instead of bloodletting to achieve any kind of catharsis or evolution beyond your grief and your PTSD. And yeah, I'm just rambling now because I love the movie so damn much. But yeah, my two from last year would be Mandy and here.
J Dog, you want to come up next?
You Were Never Really Here was my favorite movie of 2018.
Fucking A, man. Bless your heart.
Although
that excites
me. Letterboxd, it's a 2017 because I guess it was in a festival, whatever. But yeah. And there were some other things that I really liked. Like, you know, I'm a regular Marvel movie goofball fan. I feel like have we done 2018 for some reason, Spencer?
We did 2019 for the Joel Mamet movie.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know. Because I feel like I talked about how much I love Annihilation, that sci-fi movie that Amazon released, and it was Amazon, wasn't it?
Netflix.
Oh, it was Netflix.
Yeah. Netflix had a thing of like it was like 2 weeks in the theaters.
Yeah.
And then Netflix had the rights to it.
Yeah.
Because someone sold it off or something.
I feel like at the time, for some reason, it got pretty much ignored by audiences. It was in the theater for longer than that. Like, for some reason, the deal was that it was going to end up on Netflix.
Where I live, it was 2 weeks. I got to see it in
the
theater.
Oh, yeah, you're lucky. You got to see it at all. but it's such a great atmospheric, freaking scary horror sci-fi. Like, I can't think of another movie. You're going to have to go back to some alien stuff to get that
Stalker.
Real creepy feeling that this one gives. A Stalker? Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, obviously, I don't know if the story was inspired by that, but it definitely has
it's
that
like,
same sense.
It feels like Stalker if it was more approachable in certain ways.
Yeah. The other psychedelic trip out, I'm maybe the only person I know that's a huge fan of the Suspiria remake, and I love the original. I'm not talking about the original. I'm talking about the Suspiria as its own movie. And it, you know, it's like people are like, it's overly long. Like, it's not. I don't really know what the rest of the complaints are. That's usually the one I heard was like, oh, it's just so long. Like, I don't know what. I was hanging on every bit of it. Like, I was so into the way it looked and the way it sounded and the acting, you know, and the way they were laying out the story through, not through telling a tale, but rather just seeing the lives of these people. And you know, the batshit crazy ending, spoiler, it has a batshit crazy ending. Is so good that end set piece, I feel like. But I know that's not necessarily popular opinion. Spencer, don't you not like it?
Correct. But I didn't see it in a theater, so maybe that was a difference.
Yeah, I saw it like in some fancy, you know, I live near Santa Barbara, which has its own film festival, and we saw it in the theater. It had like amazing sound and everything like that, so it did make a difference. But I, you know, I own a copy too, and I've enjoyed it. So
I would have had to drive like an hour 40 to the nearest theater. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, time to
that
move.
Would have been like a whole day. Yeah, no, it's been time to move.
Yeah,
but for me. My favorite movie of last year was A Season in France by Mohamed Salah Haroun, my favorite filmmaker. It's one of his French movies. He goes between doing a movie in France and a movie in Chad, where he's from. But A Season in France is about a family from Central African Republic, and their immigration status is in question, and it's this very human story of the life of what it's like to be an immigrant where in France, when your status of whether or not you can stay in a country is up in the air. And it's a very gut-wrenching movie. It's probably his most depressing movie, but and it's just a, it's even though it's like African immigrants in Paris, it's still very universal, because that's the immigrant story is one of the most universal stories out there. And I love Haroon. It feels different than other movies. It's a little bit, but it's just a very great human story of what's of like this like a clash of culture, and deals with like class and this like there's a whole bunch of is that it's very political without being over head with it. But yeah, it's Haroon. If you're into Haroon, check it out. And the other one for me was I think I count as a movie from last year, even though fresh release in 2017. This French movie called Ava, about a teen girl who goes on vacation with her mom and a little brother, a little sister. It's a baby. And the girl's going blind, and she's kind of a troubled girl, and she makes some very poor choices, and hangs out with some people she shouldn't be hanging out with. And it's this movie about like a parent's worst nightmare, and it's pretty hard to watch at certain points. And if you do watch it, I need to give a warning. There is frontal nudity of the actress who is over 18, but she's playing 14. The director, writer of it, Leia, some French name is hard to say, has talked about this in interviews. So like it's, you know, it's still a little weird, but it's but Ava is just I won't say what the big plot thing happens, but like it's definitely worth tracking down. I guess if her first movie Upgrade, if you just want to like have a fun time, even though it has a sad ending.
And if I can throw out one more, to Karen Kusama's Destroyer with Nicole Kidman, really great film that subverts the lone wolf cop genre. Really incredible look at guilt and remorse and tragedy and time. We did it dirty when it came out. Not enough people saw it. It's really, really, really fucking good.
It's on Hulu still, I think. I'm not sure. It was there for a long time. Oh, I forgot to mention Phantom Thread. You know, it's PTA. It's the one, I haven't seen all those movies, but it's the one I like the most. And I'm pretty surprised I liked it as much as I did. Costume dramas are not something I usually like, but this is one that really struck me, and it's of the PTA that has stuck with me the longest.
And are you calling it a costume drama because they make costumes?
It's a period piece.
I mean,
it's
I guess.
like what? Like it's about like the making dresses and like in fashion, and like it. Nothing about it appeals to me, but it's a great movie.
This seems like, interesting. Cares to argue with you.
Okay. You hear my cat in the background?
Yes.
Yeah, so Phantom Thread, it's... it kind of got ignored last year for some reason, which is kind of weird, because like PTA kind of makes movies sporadically, so...
Well, it's his last one, isn't
it? I'm surprised that...
That was... what's his name's last one?
He's... Yeah, allegedly. We'll see. That's it. So, Travis, what this comes out at the end of December. What's coming up for you?
It's coming up for me. I'm doing a podcast of my own called Increment Vice. It's some really nerdy shit where me and some cool guests sit around and we talk about Inherent Vice by the one and only Paul Thomas Anderson. I know that sounds super nerdy, and it is, but it's also, I think, really cool because it's in as much as it's about that film, breaking it down an episode at a time, one scene at a time, one scene per episode. We also just explore the really cool themes of the movie and go on broader tangents, you know, about regret and time and love lost and films noir and California noirs and LA noirs, and it's a lot of fun. There's been a lot of cool people on it so far, like Kim Morgan and Drew McQueenie. And we're gonna have some cool people coming up, like Rian Johnson, who just
Holy
had a
shit.
film called Knives Out. He made some. Apparently, he made some sci-fi movie or some space movie like a year or two ago, with spaceships and wizards and something like that. I don't remember the name, but yeah, he'll be on. Some cast members from the movie will be on. All sorts of cool people will be on. And so yeah, you can check that out at incrementvice.com. And then elsewhere, I'm just going to spend most of my time writing for places like Brightwall Dark Room and the New Beverly Cinema, and that's going to be my 2020, I think.
Okay. Joel, do you have any podcast stuff coming up?
No updates, nothing new. Just this stupid podcast. No, wait, sorry. Yeah. Actually, you can hear me on previous episodes, all of them, except for there's a
A
couple I missed
couple.
recently, but yeah.
What's for not for me? I'm back on writing for my site again, Jailhouse 701, Japanese Cult Cinema. I just did a review for Gate of Flesh, my favorite Joe Tsuchiya movie, my favorite Seiji Suzuki movie. It's Golden Girls in post-war Tokyo, but they're prostitutes who don't need a pimp, who can do it on their own. But then a hunky man gets involved, played by Joe Tsuchiya with his puffy chipmunk cheeks. And yeah, it's a very interesting post-war Japanese film. Yeah, I'm gonna get back on updating that regularly. This comes out in late December, so shortly after this episode will be Chameleon Street episode. Another time I'll drop a Chameleon Street episode, and then we're gonna do Shoplifters, first one of next year. I'm looking forward to watching that movie again. And I think the special episode for January is the documentaries. Who knows how that'll turn out?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got like, what, 10 hours of documentaries to watch for that one?
Oh yeah, and I'm a big fan of docu. I watch maybe two a year. So.
Yeah. That'd be fun. But yeah, we have to cover the Spike documentaries at some point. So yeah. And I don't remember what pairing is after this. It doesn't matter. So, Travis, thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm always up for talking about Spike, especially this film.
We have a couple spikes left that I can tell you off record.
Cool.
But I'll warn you, none of them look too good. Yeah, so see you guys next time for Chameleon Street or Shoplifters. I haven't decided yet. Also, Happy New Year because it's coming out around New Year's.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com and Spotify and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.